1,865 people killed, tens of thousands homeless, and many more still unaccounted for tonight after the worst disaster Nepal has seen in nearly a century.
The tsunami death toll continues to rise as the real extent of the devastation unfolds.
Thousands of people have finally been evacuated from the shattered city of New Orleans a week after Hurricane Katrina struck.
We are in the middle of a heat wave here in northern India, the likes of which we haven't seen in nearly two decades. The temperature's hitting nearly 120 degrees, and still despite that...
When a natural disaster happens, it's hard to not hear about it. Normally, all the news stations are flooded with to-the-minute updates. The death toll is rising, it's not over yet, how will they rebuild? A disaster is defined as a sudden accident or a natural catastrophe that causes great damage or loss of life. So obviously, we have the right to know what's going on. What if you have family where the disaster has hit? How long is it going to be until it's over? It's funny how strongly the dates of natural disasters can stick in your mind. I remember sitting down for dinner with my mum and sister on the night of February 7 back in 2009. This was when the nation heard the first breaking news announcements of the Black Saturday bushfires.
Already the confirmed death toll stands at 36 and it's expected to climb much higher. Police say six people have died at King Lake and another six at King Lake West. There are four dead at St. Andrews.
Looking back, this was a really scary moment because over the next couple of months, it would unfold to be one of the worst natural disasters to hit Australia ever. What made it even weirder was that it was also my sister's birthday on the same day. Disasters can be hard to forget. But what happens to those who are forgotten when disaster strikes?
Might not think this, but following the Indian Ocean tsunami in 2004, people started to talk about tsunami marriages.
This is Gabrielle Sim. Gabrielle recently spoke at a conference in New Orleans about gender and natural disaster and how women are left worse off than men when disaster strikes.
Maybe the mother of a family was killed and the father is left with a lot of children to look after, and he's thinking partly about making his daughter safe, and girls are often perceived to be safer when they're married, and partly that's one less mouth to feed.
This is just one example, and you'll hear from Gabrielle throughout this story. But before we untangle this issue further, how many people are affected by disaster?
At the end of 2015, there were 60 million people affected by conflict and about 109 million people affected by natural disasters.
This is Angela Dawson from the University of Technology, Sydney.
I'm a senior lecturer here in the Faculty of Health.
Angela also does a lot of work in this area of women and disaster.
Women and children are an extremely vulnerable group in the sense that they're at greater risk of violence, sexual violence.
This is particularly common in places like disaster relief camps. Gabrielle Sim says the same.
People wouldn't go to the shelter because they saw it as more dangerous than staying home. They were at more greater risk of sexual assault, different types of violence in the shelter than they were in their own house.
And this leads to other complications. Back to Angela.
But also women still require family planning and contraception in such crises.
Access to contraception and proper reproductive health care, Angela says, is a crucial part of disaster relief for women. She talks about a group called the Interagency Working Group on Reproductive Health and Humanitarian Crises and says that two decades ago they put together a manual for field workers who help women in disaster. The manual calls for...
Attention to maternal and neonatal health.
Neonatal meaning newborn babies.
So clean delivery kits, for example, and skilling people to deal with neonatal resuscitation. Rape and violence are part of that initial package, so things such as post-exposure prophylactics for people who may have been exposed to HIV, emergency contraception to obviously prevent pregnancy in those cases, and counselling.
A lot of the time, reproductive health care in disaster is pushed aside because for most, their first priority is to stay alive.
Yes, so we always have the priority issue. Syria, for example, it's just very difficult to get things out, not just condoms and contraception, but food. So these supply issues concern all aspects of humanitarian response.
And sometimes certain countries don't want that type of care.
During Typhoon Yolanda in the Philippines in 2015, when 6,000 people died. The Philippines is a country where the church is very prominent, the Roman Catholic Church, and contraception or family planning and contraception, although they are great programs, emergency contraception is seen as an abortifacient, not part of the contraceptive group. So the UNFPA reproductive health kits must be changed before the kits leave. All the emergency contraception has to be removed from those kits, which is highly problematic because, of course, it prevents women who may have been raped to have a second chance to prevent a pregnancy, or those who, in fact, are in the situation where their contraception has failed.
And what about women who experience an unwanted pregnancy?
The provision of safe abortion saves lives, millions of lives a year. So America, for example, its overseas development aid funding for abortion is completely excluded. So that puts packages such as the MISP.
MISP is the Minimum Initial Service Package, which is a response to reproductive health needs in disaster crises.
At risk of resourcing because family planning is something that America is very strong at and strongly supports. But when abortion is part of the picture, USAID will not fund those programs. So not only at the country level, but also at the donor level, abortion faces a great challenge.
Angela goes on to say that abortion is one of the biggest issues at play here because you don't want women giving birth into a disaster environment. Also, birthing facilities might be damaged, inaccessible, or there might be no one around who's competent to help women who do give birth. But on the other side, Gabrielle Sim from earlier says children play an important role in disaster response.
There's a safer schools program in ASEAN where they're using children as the educators for their parents. So teaching children makes sense in terms of them being able to look after themselves. But through children, educational programs can reach their parents so that they can educate mom and dad about how to be safer next time.
As school continues, a sense of normalcy.
Schools are often designated to be the disaster shelter. So when a whole lot of people get evacuated to a school, the lessons can't run and the children miss out on schooling. And that can really disrupt their education. So there's been a big emphasis recently on getting children back into school. So even though there's chaos around them and mum and dad might not have a home and they're still scrambling to get food or find a job, at least the kids are in school and they feel safe there and they feel like there's a bit of their life that's normal.
When Gabrielle and I were talking about this idea of normalcy in disaster, it opened up another really interesting question. In the general societal discussion about gender, it most commonly comes back to women. But what if that gender gap in disaster goes beyond women? You're listening to Think Sustainability on 2SER, and we're talking about gender and disaster. Now, if you've just joined us, I'll do a little backstepping for you. Natural disasters have always been around, but from 1980 to today, there's been nearly an 80% increase in the number of climate-related disasters. When they hit, whether it be an earthquake, a flood, a hurricane, women are often left on the fringes of care, particularly in terms of reproductive health. And evidently, there's a massive gap in the proximity of care and social treatment between the sexes. But we're talking about gender, and gender doesn't indicate just women.
But there's another group that we haven't mentioned, and that's the transgender community.
This is Gabrielle Simigan, and if you've forgotten who she's our international law expert, and she spoke at a gender and disaster conference earlier this year. So I'll let her take over from here.
There is actually one example of the Nepal earthquake last year where transgender people, known as the third sex in India and Nepal, there was actually a legal reform undertaken where they could be recognised on citizenship certificates, but the law was not being implemented in practice. So those people who, for example, might lose their house in an earthquake, they can't prove that they own it because they can't get citizenship certificate that shows that they need to get their house title. And in some countries, the deaths of transgender people aren't being recorded in the official statistics. I know that some people have been excluded from shelters. For example, sex workers have been excluded from shelters in Bangladesh. And I mean, perhaps some of those were trans sex workers. But it's really an area that needs a lot more research. And it's something that I've been trying to find out more about because I think it's important. There's also this tendency in international law generally to say gender equals women. And so whenever people say gender, they actually mean women. Whereas I think it's important to say gender is not just about women. It's also about men. It's about transgender people. And that if we really are serious about looking at gender, that we need to not see it in terms of a binary. And we also need to take into account how gender affects international law in lots of different ways.
So how would being a transgender person come into international law in this situation?
Well, the two ways in which people propose to deal with gender and disaster, I think, are actually about women. So the first one is to look at it through the Women's Convention, the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. And the second one is to use a model of women, peace and security through the Security Council. That women, peace and security agenda at the Security Council has been criticised as being actually having a very simplistic idea about women. And it sort of lets men off the hook in that the focus is all on women. For example, Laura Shepherd, who's an academic at UNSW, she said, well, we actually need a men, peace and security agenda. And Jamie Hagan has written a piece criticising the women, peace and security agenda from a queer perspective. So to think more about how using this focus on women excludes groups. So that's one way in which it's come up in the critiques of what is happening at the UN. But you're right in that it's very difficult for most people to think about how gender, sexuality is relevant at an international level. There are the Jogjakarta principles on sexuality, which are sort of non-binding human rights principles. But it's something that is being taken notice of more and more at an international level. And I think it's important that we connect things like sexuality and gender to issues like disaster, where people might think, well, how is sexuality or gender, how is it relevant to a cyclone or an earthquake? Well, it is actually, because disasters exacerbate existing inequalities and existing discrimination and biases.
Because you'd even mentioned if there were certain transgender people who'd been not allowed to come into a certain disaster relief area, then where would they go? Or what other support would they have? Or where else could they find it when things kind of die down or when it begins again?
That's right. And I mean, at the starkest form, you think, well, these people are being shut out and there's a cyclone out there and millions of people have been killed in cyclones in Bangladesh. So that is pretty serious exclusion there. But you can see the exclusion is happening. It's on an ongoing basis, but we just see it most starkly at that point. But if people can't get registered, they can't get a certificate that shows they're a citizen, if they can't register for disaster relief, if they're not even recognised as a person, so they can't show access or a title to their house. You know, that's going on all the time, and it's brought out most starkly when their death isn't even recorded as a death in the official statistics.
And this is dependent, obviously, on different countries or where different natural disasters occur. Do you, just perhaps an example, in the United States, it might be different from what happens in a Southeast Asian country. Do you know of any relief centres which provide specifically for those within the queer community?
I'm not aware of particular centres. I think there are some programs I've seen mentioned in a Red Cross report, a program specifically targeting certain groups, and they might be catered to by a particular program, but I'm not aware of like a physical space. This is for queer people.
Like so what are some of these programs?
It's more sort of outreach, making sure that people have access to aid, they have access to information. I mean, after disasters, there are a lot of livelihood programs where you're trying to get people back to work. And if I use the example of Cyclone Nargis in Myanmar in 2008, a lot of fisher people lost their boat, they lost their fishing net. So you come along, you give them a boat, you give them a fishing net. But if you've got trans people being excluded from livelihoods, apart from really marginalised ones such as sex work, then I guess there's a problem for the aid community. What do we actually give them? How do we get them back on their feet economically? How do we get them working again when they were excluded from that before the disaster? So I think it's a challenge for the humanitarian response.